Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin. I'm joined today by my colleague, Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor of Engelsberg Ideas, and he'll be familiar to many of you Reaction subscribers who received his daily briefing and much more during the pandemic, and was also with me on the podcast throughout the pandemic as we tried to make sense of what on earth was going on. We are going to be joined in a few moments by renowned sociologist, Emeritus Professor at Nottingham Trent and former government advisor Robert Dingwall. But before that, Alistair, I just wanted to take a couple of minutes because I thought we should map out our positions first, or for reasons of transparency and openness. Everyone, when discussing this, has a position. Our positions were different at various points during the pandemic. I think it's fair to say, I don't want to mischaracterise your position, but you were very sceptical of lockdowns as they happened. I became more sceptical as the pandemic rolled on and the measures intensified or weren't relaxed, and became very concerned about the economic and educational costs. But you had been ahead of me on that. I mean, how do you see it now? Do you feel, I mean, we all made mistakes during it in terms of mistakes of judgment journalistically or ethically. Everyone involved did, writing about it or being involved in attempting to run the response. But how do you feel about your view at the time now?
Well, I feel that the pandemic energised trends in modern life that to me were profoundly damaging and accelerated things that potentially could have gone in a different way. There's so many branching histories throughout COVID. And I felt that journalists didn't put enough work in to working out what was distinctive about the government's response and the way people were behaving, and what was, to me, age-old, and the way humans often respond to the threat of disease, to major societal trauma. And that led me, at various points, to be quite sceptical about what the government was doing, because I felt that a lot of people at the very top were fundamentally confused, and fundamentally confused about the both the role of science in a complex modern democracy and the degree to which, you know, the forces of science and the state, when combined, when put into a kind of coalition, could be extremely damaging. And I don't think there was enough intellectual thought put into that. There wasn't enough thought throughout the whole pandemic about what human beings really need in times of crisis. There wasn't that. There was just this kind of obsession with an overly rationalised, scientistic view of both life and our relationship with disease. And I felt that was fundamentally the issue. And it sort of didn't matter to me if a scientist was wrong on a particular judgment about the dynamics of the disease. Every single mathematical modeller made huge errors of judgment. Every single scientist on the kind of purely rational stuff got a huge amount wrong, because we're in a crisis. You get stuff wrong, you make snap judgments. Journalists are the same. But throughout the pandemic, I was always looking for contributors, for academics, for journalists who were fundamentally right, who operated on principles that were rooted in a kind of appreciation of human beings and appreciation what we could actually achieve in the face of what was happening.
I mean, I agree that at some points in this podcast, I might ask some questions that suggest I don't, for the reasons of balance. But we're joined by, now I'm delighted to say, by Robert Dingwall, who is one of those people that you described, Alistair, who you interviewed during the pandemic. Welcome, Robert. Welcome to the Reaction Podcast.
Hello.
So I wanted to begin really with a broad general question, Robert. What are your general thoughts from a distance about all of this with the benefit of hindsight? We'll come on to the COVID inquiry in more detail.
Well, generally, I suppose that to some extent it's coloured by my own previous work in the field and my involvement with thinking about pandemics really since the early 2000s. And I do remember my initial reaction to the figures that Imperial College came up with, which said that there might be 500,000 deaths. as being in terms of, oh, as few as that, because the thinking and planning that we've been doing around 2005-06 had assumed 650,000 deaths, had considered the possibility of up to several million. So I never had that kind of panicked response to numbers which we now know to have been much exaggerated, consistent with the history of that type of modelling. And that looking overall at the pandemic, we have probably come through it in worse shape than we needed to have done in terms of the social economic impact and the collateral mortality. But we haven't come through exceptionally badly in terms of excess mortality. And I think there is a narrative that's been created about British, to some extent, English exceptionalism. We had a lot of unnecessary deaths. Our performance overall is mid-table. If you take a sample, if you look at Europe as a whole, rather than cherry-picking particular countries, we come out more or less the same as sort of France or Germany, a bit worse than most of Eastern Europe. Sorry, a bit better than most of Eastern Europe, a bit worse than most of the Nordic countries. But it doesn't suggest that, you know, variations in the different public health regimes really mattered all that much, that the pandemic death rates were driven much more by the characteristics of the virus and the society into which it was entering than they were by, you know, anything that any particular country did.
Do we have any sense yet whether, if we were, your phrase, roughly mid-table in European terms, do we have any sense of where we come in terms of harms, education, healthcare? Large parts of the health service were in effect shut down to cope with the pandemic. Is there a proper assessment that can be done now of how bad the side effects were?
I've not seen such an assessment. I mean, Kevin Bardosh has attempted to do this, but the data are very limited, and there has been a reluctance, I think, in many countries, to try to produce realistic assessments. And we do have a particular problem in this country that we've been very reluctant to learn from other people's experiences. I mean, you know, everybody points to Sweden and says how well they did. I've looked quite closely at the French experience. The French did a lot of different things differently, and came out with more or less the same results as us. So I think that, you said we'd come to the inquiry. I think that the sort of not invented here is going to be a big issue by the time that the inquiry reports. And I would hope that we would have better data on, you know, the educational deficits in France and Germany, on the collateral damage in public health terms. In those countries.
Well, let's talk about the COVID inquiry now. I'm sure we'll come back to other elements of the crisis, but let's go straight in on this. It's been running for a while now. I must confess that I've become somewhat addicted to its proceedings and watching coverage of it. It's not really, of course, there's a lot else going on in the world with the crisis in the Middle East. It's not really, Alistair, getting that much attention in media terms yet. Is that because, simply as I said, there's a lot else going on, or is there embarrassment, or people don't want to hear it?
I think that it's one, people don't want to relitigate things that they found unpleasant, but number two, I think the debate hasn't quite caught up with the subtle ways in which the inquiry is hedging the whole debate about lockdowns, public health strategies. I mean, I was really bemused to hear John Edmonds, who was a scientist on the SAGE committee, talk about the period in autumn 2020 where we had a kind of partial lockdown in November and a tier system. criticising the government's approach, saying we should have gone harder earlier. And he said, and I quote, "So we just sort of threw the strategy away and then adopted a complete opposite one." I mean, let's sort of part that kind of modern myth that no problem is impervious to a strategy, sort of rationally conceived. Mm. But I think, you know, the question that I would ask someone like John Edmonds is, why are you saying strategy? Why can't we say tactics? Why couldn't we have bots clever address the character of the virus as it was, the age profile of the people it was affecting, tailored to the way people were actually going to behave? And also, it's rewriting history. Autumn 2020, I don't know about your experience, Robert, your experience, Ian, like, you know, that was a time in which we had pretty harsh restrictions on what we could do throughout the whole period. Mm. But schools went back. So are you saying that we should have not had that period in education for children? What are the actual hard choices that were made as a result of the strategy of containment? And it wasn't what John Edmonds wanted. He wanted a harder, longer lockdown, whatever, on the super rational basis that we would then leave it earlier and get the benefits from that. But anyway, Robert, I'd love to know your view on that kind of the implicit kind of reasoning that's on display at the inquiry, and to what extent we can sort of unravel that.
Yes, I mean, I think John Edmonds has been a bit of an outlier all the way through. I mean, he was, I suppose, the leader of what I would call the Eeyore tendency, where one was always looking for the gloomiest downside and the harshest restrictions from the very beginning. I think it was, I can't remember whether it was the WhatsApp messages or Hancock's book, where Hancock was saying, well, you know, why were there no plans for suppression? Well, there weren't any plans for suppression because we looked at them 20 years earlier and decided it was pointless. Respiratory viruses do what they do. And there isn't a great deal that you can do to affect that. You try to get through it with the sort of minimum of social and economic damage and with the without sort of focusing on a single outcome of minimizing COVID-related mortality. And I think that's been an error throughout, and I think it's an error that the inquiry is tending to perpetuate, at least on what it's done so far, that the obsession with reducing COVID deaths has, in a sense, overtook any kind of appreciation of the opportunity costs of doing that, and the extent to which a focus on one solitary cause of death would actually cause other deaths, which might well be more significant in terms of life years lost.
Yeah. One of the most curious aspects of the inquiry so far has been that day in which John Edmonds gave evidence or was cross-examined for 3 hours, and then now, this has had some attention, not a lot, but some attention among publications that are covering it, when Carl Hennigan was then given an hour. And I'm going to say, having watched it, treated very rudely and dismissively. Interestingly, there's a piece in The Critic magazine which covers all of this, and we'll put the link in below in the piece that we write about this by Christopher Snowden, which shows that actually, I mean, Edmonds in March, on, you know, March 12th, 13th, was on television. These clips are on YouTube. They haven't been memory-holed. They haven't disappeared, but they're not referenced anywhere I can see in the inquiry, pushing what amounts to the herd immunity strategy or the sticking to the original plan. But that's not raised by the inquiry. Was he just sticking with the government line because that's what you do in an official position, or doesn't seem to be any evidence behind the scenes at that point that he was demanding a completely different approach? And it seems there, Christopher Snowden phrases it very well, saying that there's an official new narrative of COVID and early COVID being established at the inquiry, which really worries me. That somehow the hopeless politicians, and the politicians were hopeless in certain respects, and human beings in a crisis, had to be pushed by a group of brave scientists who were emailing them and WhatsApping them until they listened and they saw the light, and they saw the light on the toughest lockdown possible, and then try to row back from it in in the autumn and beyond. But of course, history's messier than that, isn't it, Robert? I'm not convinced by the story that the inquiry seems determined to construct.
Well, very much so. And I think it also fails to draw the proper distinction between the politicians and the scientists. That the constitutionally, I mean, SAGE exists to give advice, not to drive policy. And I thought James Rubin, co-chair of SPY-B, was quite interesting in his evidence on that, which said, look, you know, we give our advice, but in the end, the politicians have to put that into a much wider context, and they're entitled to do that. I suppose a particularly good example of that is Eat Out to Help Out, which has been widely trashed by the epidemiologists. On the other hand, if you come at it from a Treasury perspective, what it does is to provide support for a significant sector of the economy, which is in pretty desperate trouble by that point. You could also construct an argument that says, look, you know, the pandemic has frightened the population. It's caused a great deal of anxiety. You know, let's give them a bit of support through the summer months when transmission is likely to be low, where there isn't really any competition between opening hospitality and opening schools, as has been made out. You know, let's encourage people to get out and relax, and let's do something about this climate of fear that has been that has been whipped up by various other factions within the government and the science community. So there's a perfectly reasonable case to make for Eat Out to Help Out. But it involves accepting that the minimization of COVID mortality is not the overriding priority compared with the wider social and economic health of the society.
Do you think that the inquiry has been fundamentally misdesigned in terms of its remit?
I think the problem is very much that it's been constructed as a lawyer-led inquiry. Now, it's a bit of blowing my own trumpet. I first wrote about the problems of lawyer-led inquiries when I was studying child abuse back in the late 70s, early 80s. And I wrote a paper which was in the Modern Law Review of all places, examining the deficiencies of lawyer-led models. And I think it's quite instructive to compare this inquiry with the Grenfell inquiry, which has made much better use of professional expertise alongside the judge who's chairing it, and alongside the legal team who are preparing the evidence and examining the witnesses. And I think that it's quite clear from the lines of questioning and from the sort of attitude struck by some counsel and by the judge that there is a real struggle to grasp the problem. I mean, Alistair was responding earlier to these issues about, you know, the place of disease in society, about the sort of competing claims, about the opportunity costs, about the construction of alternative scenarios, the counterfactuals, and about the questions of the sort of narrow base of recruitment to the scientific evidence that was being presented to government. I mean, it's overwhelmingly dominated by Oxford, Cambridge and London, academics based there or members of their social networks. It's a very narrow input. Now, clearly, government are talking to other people. The Treasury in particular has its own range of advisors. There are other sources of information that the civil service have available to them. But publicly, at least, you have this sort of focus on, you know, one contributing faction, which is really quite a narrow part of the of that sort of policy network. And I think you saw that in the contrast between the treatment of the SAGE witnesses. It's not just Edmonds. I mean, Farrow gets this sort of long rehearsal of his eminence and his qualifications, whereas you know, Hennigan is just sort of glossed over. You know, you're professor of evidence-based medicine. What's that? With no real sense of, you know, how, what the credentials might be, how you might have got there, what your status in that community might be. And it's also instructive, I think. I make the point in an article in The Telegraph this week about the kind of class attitudes that permeate the council's approach to Hennigan. You know, Carl is what he is. He's a working class lad from up north, you know, who's retained a lot of the sort of manners and interactional style that goes with that. You know, he's not sort of acquired the sort of veneer of articulacy that goes with college dinners, that goes with, you know, dining at the Inns of Court, that goes with invitations to North London dinner parties. And it, again, if you look at that examination, you know, what you're seeing is a sort of adversarial cross-examination that you might see in court, rather than an attempt to elucidate his position and arguments for the instruction of the public, which you might properly expect from an inquiry.
Let's go through some of the hearings, or some of what I'm referring to, hearings, some written evidence, but the positions of some of the principal characters are now very clear. Dominic Cummings, of course, is coming, I think, early next week, actually. So we'll see Cummings under cross-examination on next week. But let's just begin quickly with Boris. What did you make of the whole approach that he adopted? I mean, was there something fundamentally flawed in his character that meant that dealing with a pandemic was always going to be difficult, but that it became more difficult because of his character? Or, as his defenders would point out, we could have been stuck in lockdown for even longer if Boris Johnson hadn't been Prime Minister in the early 21 and beyond. I can think of characters who might have been leader of the Conservative Party at that point who would have been almost for the zero COVID position. Where do you stand, Robert, on Boris's role?
Well, I don't really move in such elevated circles, but I think what I would say is, yes, I think that Boris's challenge to the scientific advice is a proper function. I mean, what I have read is that Boris's talents as Mayor of London were in hiring good advisors who really helped him to think through issues, and that he lacked advisors of that quality in helping him to navigate not just the pandemic but other challenges in government. I think that the sort of pushback, it's what the politicians should have been there for. And given that Hancock wasn't making a great job of that at health, I think that to have the advice received with this sort of scepticism was probably helpful to the process. I mean, the problem may have been that we don't actually know about the other sorts of advice that Boris was receiving, and we probably won't know about those for a long time to come. But clearly, you know, MI5 are having an input, the GCHQ are having an input, the police are having an input, MPs are having an input. There's a lot of competing advice coming in. And it's quite proper for the PM to be saying back to the scientists, look, I'm not persuaded by the case that you're making, which, if you like, goes beyond your lane of describing the problems into prescribing particular solutions. Any science problem has policy options. It doesn't usually dictate a single choice.
I think their concern, and their concern very early in the pandemic, in February, March 2020 will have been, in fact, I remember conversations at the time, will have been about social order. And not at that point knowing or having enough certainty on what the disease was going to do and how it was going to perform and who it was going to kill, the concern was then, well, how does the supermarket logistics system work? How does basic functions like water supply work if you have significant parts of the workforce off, ill, unable to function? So in the chaos of that period, I can understand why they went for a draconian approach in the very early stages, almost to try and get a handle on what was going on. What I find bizarre, and I've yet to encounter anyone who claims that they said this in any of the key meetings, or there's no record that I can find of it, that no one said, right, okay, planning to close the schools as a precautionary measure, which means locking up millions of children, locking children halfway up tower blocks, unable to get out and exercise, children stuck in some of the toughest neighbourhoods, denied education, denied socialisation. Right, OK, that's the plan is to do that for 2, 3, 4 weeks, maybe until after the Easter holidays. But you're talking about doing that indefinitely? That is completely mad. But no one with influence in the system that I can found or who's gone on record said that in those meetings. Does that strike you as odd?
Well, it is part and parcel of the abandonment of all the work that had been done for the previous 20 years to plan for a pandemic of a respiratory disease. And the this claim that came in very early that COVID is unique, that all the work that we'd done on pandemic influenza was to be set to one side because this wasn't influenza, this was COVID. And therefore, everything had to be rethought on an emergency basis. Now, the questions that you're posing are questions that had been considered at great length in 2005, 6, 7. They've been revisited after the swine flu 2009 pandemic, where the approach was broadly endorsed by the subsequent inquiry by Dame Deirdre Hine. They've been revisited in various, quote, war games, unquote, throughout the decade. How do we keep the supermarkets stocked? How do we keep the petrol stations full? Plans had been drawn up for this, but they were set aside for reasons that, some of it was revealed by the war games. Cuts to emergency planning, retirements, loss of organizational memory. Documents have gone into cupboards or electronic archives. But in a way, it's the job of the Cabinet Office, of the emergency planners there to keep track of this sort of thing. Mm. But I remember it's an early meeting of the Moral and Ethical Advisory Group. We had somebody come along who said, well, what are we going to do with all the bodies? And two of us who were on that group, who'd been involved in 2005-06, said, well, there's a plan. But the plan exists in the Home Office because that's the Home Office responsibility. You'll probably find it in the National Archives. The plan had been drawn up looking back to nuclear warfare planning of the 50s, looking back to mass casualty planning of the 40s. And all of that work had been done. And it was either ignored or it had been forgotten. There was never any consideration of closing schools in the pandemic flu planning for all the reasons that you've described. Plus the fact that if you close schools, you immediately strip a lot of parents out of the workforce because they have to stay home anyway, regardless of any lockdown order. And we realized that the National Health Service would not cope. If you suddenly said a lot of women are going to come out of the NHS workforce because their kids are at home.
Yeah.
And it was the only reason that we envisaged closing schools in the pandemic flu planning was if so many teachers were sick that you couldn't operate them safely, even with assistance from volunteers or from, you know, retired teachers, students coming in. There was a bit of discussion about, well, you know, maybe the community could set in and people could be neighbourly. And we just said, look, you know, this is a paedophile's charter. You know, the friendly neighbour who offers to look after the children of the street with no checking or monitoring. At least if you have the kids in school, you can check up on those sorts of things.
Yeah. Do you think in the search for an explanation on why the system behaved as it did, to what extent, I just want to deal with this relatively quickly, is Brexit a factor? Because Michael Gove says that the Brexit preparations had made Britain match ready, I think the phrase was. Others, Nicola Sturgeon, disagreed. Roger Hargreaves, who's director of the government's COBRA crisis management hub, gave evidence saying that the system had been pulled out of shape by planning for Brexit and other things. I mean, which is it, do you think?
Oh, I think it's the diversion of civil service resources. I mean, it's also the skills of emergency planners were precisely the skills that you needed to plan for Brexit. You know, how do you keep the supermarket shelves full if all your trucks are held up at Dover? Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly the same problem. I mean, the drivers and the trucks can't get on the road, either because they're stuck in traffic jams or because they're off sick, and you end up with empty shelves. Yeah. And that was exactly the skill set that you need to sort that problem out.
There was also political class exhaustion after the 2019 election, which of course had happened in December. So it's almost the winning party collapses over the finishing line, exhausted by the whole Brexit drama, the election, early 2020. It's Brexit night or leaving the European Union night on the 31st of January, which is the first time I remember having a serious discussion about COVID, and Matt Ridley that evening at a party saying that this might be a really serious situation that could turn into a pandemic. But the politicians were exhausted. Alistair, you wanted to come in on this.
Robert, do you think it's a sort of cultural problem? You know, why are these people behaving in the way that they did, and why is it so widespread? In that it feels like at the moment we are addicted to a kind of presentism, and we kind of do it on all kinds of debates, whether it's defence, whether it's kind of geopolitical stuff. It's like expertise unmoored from a deep historical perspective. You know, you're talking about planning that went back decades. Is it just a lack of curiosity that says we don't need to look at the planning that was done 50 years ago, because the threat is so new, the threat is so, you know, it calls for new answers? And isn't that just a kind of clever and sophisticated way, I guess, of saying we don't need history? You know, we can do it ourselves. Do you think that's a kind of cultural problem?
Yes, I think that there is a devaluing of history. I mean, my approach has been much influenced by a really rather brilliant paper that was written by my PhD supervisor and friend, Philip Strong, who died sadly young. But he was engaged to work on a history of AIDS policy in the 1980s. And one of his first actions was to go back and look at the management of previous epidemics and pandemics from the 14th century, the Black Death onwards. And he identified pandemics as characterized by three social panics: a panic of fear, a panic of explanation, and a panic of action. The novelty of the infection generated fear in the population. This in turn produced a demand for explanation. Lots of people piled in with competing accounts. And a demand for action, that, you know, something must be done, even if there is nothing sensible that can be done. And I think we saw a, a, a lot of that. I mean, the fear was instigated by whoever. The fear was amplified. Explanations appeared all over the place. And it's clear, I think, from what Hancock has put in the public, what's in the public domain about Hancock's position, that he just wanted something done. And he was complaining about why there weren't stockpiles of antivirals for coronaviruses. Well, there aren't stockpiles because they don't exist. He was complaining about why there was no planning for suppression. Well, the people who looked at the problem knew this wasn't a practical outcome. We have this great resistance to the, to the evaluation of any of these non-pharmaceutical interventions. I mean, some of us were calling for randomized trials of masking, from the very beginning. But, we piled a lot of money into evaluating drugs and vaccines and we ran some great trials. And I don't for a moment dismiss the science there, but we never put a matching effort into evaluating the non-pharmaceutical interventions because self-evidently they were action and action was good.
A quick question. I do like that idea of you encapsulate that really, really well. The three psychological epidemics that accompany a medical epidemics. You talked about fear, moralization, then action. What about the zero COVID movement, which fits with all of those three phenomenon? But it was very popular for a while, wasn't it? It was common to see Nicola Sturgeon, now out of office, Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, now out of office. It was a mainstream narrative for quite a long time that they somehow were more on top of this and had some insight that other politicians lacked.
Yes, I mean, if you look at the results for Scotland, they're not very different from the results for England. If you look at the results for New Zealand, you get a big exit wave, and you could actually say that New Zealand had, by being able to shut itself off, had a free ride on the experience of the rest of the planet in developing the vaccines and the other pharmaceutical interventions. I mean, it always puzzled me why anybody took zero COVID seriously. I have friends who'd worked on smallpox eradication, and I know how difficult that was. I've looked at the progress that's been made towards the eradication of polio and measles. And, you're talking about 20 or 30 year challenges, which are extremely difficult, require a lot of international cooperation, a lot of resources, and were not going to be achieved by the kinds of methods that the zero COVID movement was proposing. Mm. And it always baffled me why anybody would take that seriously unless it was bound up with what I think the political scientists would call a kind of deep green agenda about the number of humans on the planet and their relationship with the natural world, and that it's a way to advance a different or wider set of goals about human societies and their relationships with nature.
I think there's something in that, and it's also very reassuring. Thinking particularly of Scotland, it's a very reassuring, very middle class, professional way to think about the problem, and something which, I mean, I wonder whether people don't really want to think about what happened and what was done, particularly to pupils from disadvantaged backgrounds, in terms of what they lost out on, is that a lot of people actually rather enjoyed it and felt some sort of moral vindication by tuning in for the Nicola Sturgeon daily briefing, and they were pretty much daily, in which she explained that she was doing something really morally superior to the chaotic English, and out of that, just that earned her respect. So whatever she said, those messages were picked on. Well, if Nicola Sturgeon says it and they seem to be on top of things, then that must be the case. And just step by step, people lost their reason, and to a point where they thought that zero COVID, clearly a mad idea, was somehow an achievable policy. Alistair.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about ideas like international solidarity in the face of the virus. For a long time we were invited to see New Zealand. And New Zealand's an interesting one in the British imagination, because we, I think, have ingested a very Kiwi idea that New Zealand is a kind of better Britain. That was a kind of major national myth throughout the 20th century, that New Zealand was kind of a better mix of a British culture, a kind of, closer to the natural world, a kind of new Britain across the way. And I think we've kind of ingested that and recapitulated it with this perception of New Zealand as a really deeply moral, lovely place. But what did the New Zealand state contribute in terms of, finding treatments like dexamethasone, which was run here in the UK, through massive, large-scale trials, through the recovery trial, for example, developing a vaccine, testing it at scale, which is really the crucial thing. I always felt early on the pandemic, that our focus as journalists should be, what are the treatments that are being worked on and will they work? And that should be what journalists are constantly elaborating. I don't think we did that.
Yeah. Can I just put the counter case to both of you? Because there will be people listening to this saying, fine, after the event, but maybe doctors, people who were on the front line in hospitals, and I've certainly had this in encounter several times with people who were working in hospitals saying, listen, you have no idea how bad it was in the early months, in March, April, May. The system was almost at breaking point. You had effectively the collapse of social care, and you then had doctors, largely above a certain age, getting ill. And if there hadn't been these measures, Robert, the death toll would have been much worse, and you would have had something close to social collapse.
Well, it's really hard to disentangle all the elements in that briefly, but I think the important thing to remember is that hospital doctors see a very unrepresentative sample of illness in the population, and a lot of policy making was skewed by that. The WHO investigation in China in February 2020 pointed to probably 80% of the people who contracted COVID never needing to go near a hospital. Even when they did get into a hospital, initially the hospitals were doing what they thought was the right thing by admitting patients to intensive care and intubating them, which is resource intensive. But actually, and this is, again, it's a real achievement for British medicine, is discovering how quickly this was a really bad idea, and that it was probably killing more patients than it was saving.
Can you just explain that? Why is it a bad idea?
Well, the combination of the sort of heavy sedation required, this is on my understanding of it. There are clinicians who would understand this much better. The combination of the heavy sedation and the sort of intrusion of the breathing tubes actually compromise the patient's ability to mobilize an immune response to the an effective immune response to the infection. When the hospital started using masks, oxygen masks, and CPAP, it's continuous positive airway pressure, which they initially did as a sort of, we can't get everybody into the ICU, so let's see what this does. Turns out it's a lot more effective because it doesn't involve the degree of sedation and the sort of suppression of body functions that's required for intensive care treatment. Intensive care is not really treatment. Intensive care is essentially about immobilizing the patient while the natural healing forces take over. Again, outsiders, I think, often have a rather simplistic view of what can be achieved in intensive care.
Final question, Alistair first, have the lessons been learned? I mean, clearly not, if based on our discussion on the COVID inquiry and the problems with the inquiry that's unfolding. But are you confident that sufficient people are learning the lessons, or, you know, where are we?
It's unclear to me whether that kind of public dogma we've elaborated that really replaced a deep perspective or a real leadership or real advice as conceived by centuries of insight and wisdom from across world culture, whether that public dogma is as widely shared as it is among a particular class background as it is in the UK. That,
overrepresented in journalism.
Well, of course, overrepresented in journalism. It's unclear to me whether that is as widely shared in the general population as in, yeah, as in the people we're talking about. So I do have some hope, yeah. But, I mean, ultimately, what worries me is we will face future crises in this century, which demands a combination of leadership, intuition, deep perspective, the right advice, going to the right people, an element of luck. You know, luck's always chance, always very important. People really undervalued that, I think, throughout the COVID pandemic, over-rationalising what we could and couldn't do. So are those elements in place at the top of British public life, in the places that make the decisions, in the places that really matter? And in the pandemic, we saw what the state could do in coalition with the forces of modern science, unharnessed from a kind of humanities view, a kind of a realistic view of what human beings couldn't do. That had some achievements. You know, we rolled out vaccines across a whole population quickly. We maybe got out of it faster if our basis was let's minimise COVID deaths while reopening. It did us some service, but it also did a huge amount of harm and damage. But I think that damage is more fundamental than simply pandemics. It's across all kinds of crises.
Yeah.
Are we learning that distinctive and probably more, you know, a bit more highfalutin message that sometimes crises you need like a weird combination of stuff to come together to leave us in a state which is more resilient?
It may be a manifestation of something which is happening across politics, business, public life, which is that the social media age is actually still relatively new and it's unleashed pretty frightening forces, which mean that a lot of what used to work in politics, in political communication, speed of decision making, how you talk about a crisis, how you make those decisions, if you're Margaret Thatcher or Gordon Brown. I mean, Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling were operating in the financial crisis in an era that's effectively before social media. We think it's quite recent, or I do, being old and having written about it. But actually, it happened in an era that's before the change. And it is discombobulating. And you can see this in various crises, in the Middle East crisis, and the way in which that is being shaped by the social media debate, the capacity for people's endless capacity for outrage and shock and anger. And it's almost history speeding up. And it may be that we look back and see the politicians' response and their cluelessness at key moments, particularly early on, as being a manifestation of a deeper problem. Robert?
Yeah, I think I would perhaps make two observations. I mean, first is that I think that the pandemic management has underlined the limitations of what I've called elsewhere patrician policy making, you know, where a fairly narrow and closed elite operates in a rather paternalist fashion for everybody else. I mean, very crudely, pandemic policy was made by people who lived in houses with gardens for people who didn't. And those of us whose research and life experiences included spending time in the homes of some of the poorest people in the country, being aware of the living conditions of overcrowding, multi-generational households, the importance of access to public open spaces for people who don't have gardens, if you like. That I think is a real limitation on the political class and the media class. the other thing I would say is I'm more positive about social media because I think it's compensated for the lack of diversity and resilience in the advisory networks and in the flow of information to the policymakers, to the policy community. It has allowed excluded voices to, you know, to make their case and to be heard in a way that I think would otherwise be very difficult. Now, some of those voices are conspiracy theorists, some of them are cranks, but some of them are representative of responsible bodies of scientific opinion, which would not otherwise be recognised by the networks. I think the treatment of Carl Hennigan by the Inquiry is a nice example of that. And from a politician's point of view, I think that is probably a good thing. But the lesson may well be, how do we create a more diversified scientific and social scientific advisory network, rather than, you know, we have to rely on sort of social media and the more or less free market that it represents to, you know, to sort of throw up the alternative analyses and policy options that we should be considering.
Very interesting. Yeah, something you said there about lockdown reminded me of whoever said it first during the pandemic. It was a genius observation. Lockdown, where middle-class people hide indoors and are brought parcels by working-class delivery drivers.
Indeed.
Just quick final question. Robert, will it be different next time if it happens?
Again, I think it's an interesting question. It depends how quickly. I think it will take us a decade to digest the experience and come to the conclusions. I think that, you know, we might learn some lessons, and I think we'll then forget them. And I think I have very little faith in the institutional memory of British institutions under present conditions for the reasons that Alistair has set out.
Robert Dingwall, on that note, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for joining us on the Reaction podcast. You've been listening to the Reaction podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin, with my colleague today, Alistair Benn. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction, go to the website www.reaction.life and you can become an annual subscriber, where you get my weekly newsletter on politics, geopolitics, economics, culture. You also get all of the work of the team every day with their daily briefing. Until next time, thank you for listening.